You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
All right, everybody, that's right. It is Mike Hagan, and you are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. Our guest this evening is Dr. Bruce Lipton. Dr. Lipton is an internationally recognized cell biologist. He received his PhD degree from the University of Virginia at Charlottesville before joining the Department of Anatomy at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine in 1973. Always interested in the mechanisms that drive and control cell behavior, Dr. Lipton began examining the principles of quantum physics and how they might be integrated into his understanding of the cell's information and the processing systems that run them. This synthesis has led to breakthroughs of many sorts, some of which we will talk about tonight, starting right now as we say hello and welcome to Radio Orbit, Dr. Bruce Lipton.
Mike, thank you very much for this opportunity. I appreciate it.
It's a privilege to have you on the show.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it because we have so many wonderful possible topics. Whatever we hit, it's sort of like roulette. Just hit one of them, we're going to go with it.
All right. Well, I think the way we're going to start is for the people who aren't familiar with you and your work, and it is the first time that you've been a guest on the program, so I'd like to just ask you a little bit about yourself. Maybe you could tell people a little bit about your background and how you got on this particular path that led to the work that you're doing and, of course, the book, The Biology of Belief, which is a remarkable publication.
Well, it all started, as they say, when I was actually a kid, and I was in grade school in New York, and I looked through the microscope. The first time we had a microscope in second grade, and I looked inside and saw an amoeba and a paramecium, and I was just, like, transfixed. I was like, wow. You know, it's like they were just like these miniature people to me as a kid.
It's one of the first stories that you relate in your book, and it's a fascinating one for sure.
Well, it's real interesting because the fact was I was so taken by it in that second grade and ultimately end up to become a cellular biologist and electron microscopist from that moment of like awe to that to that point. So I had the unique and wonderful opportunity of doing my research at the University of Virginia where I was getting my PhD, and I worked with a professor, Erwin Konigsberg, and it was like it was the greatest experience of my life because at that time, and this was back in the 1960s, in fact 1967, Konigsberg had developed cloning techniques for stem cells. He was the only one. I mean, it was like this man cloned, you know, was like the first cloning of stem cells. So I worked in his laboratory, and I just had the greatest of opportunities to work with stem cells 40 years ago. People talk about them today, it's like they're real exciting. Well, 40 years ago, there's only a few of us that were really working on them. And the most exciting turn of events was that I was teaching in the medical school at that time, teaching cell biology and all that, and teaching the conventional dogma of the story about how genes control life, which is, you know, built in all the books everywhere. And so I'm teaching medical students this story. And in the laboratory, I'm running these experiments, and basically what I do is to clone a stem cell. You isolate and identify one stem cell, and you put it into a culture dish by itself. And when that cell divides and divides and divides, ultimately you get a large number of cells, like thousands of cells.
Right.
But they're all genetically the same because they came from the exact same parent cell.
Mm-hmm.
So that you start with genetically identical cells. And then one of the experiments that I ended up publishing was I changed the conditions in the petri plate for my stem cell. And so I start with the uniform population, and I split them up into three groups. So they're all genetically identical cells in three different tissue culture dishes. And in each dish, I change the culture medium conditions a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I put them back in the incubator, and then when I came back a few days later and looked at them, that in one dish, the cells form muscle. In the other dish, the cells form bone. And in the third dish, the cells form fat cells.
Remarkable.
To me, the big shock was, here I am teaching that genes control life, and the reality was, wait a minute, these were genetically identical cells put into the environment.
Right.
And then you have to just step back and, you know, say, well, what controlled, why did one cell become muscle and another bone? Where was the control? And the answer was, well, since all the cells were exactly the same, the only thing that was different was the environment.
Right.
So it said, wait a minute, the environment is influencing what the cells become. Well, I'm teaching on the hall in the classroom, the genes control life, and then up the hall in my laboratory, the cells are revealing, no, genes didn't control what they did. The environment controlled what they did. It's like, wow. There's a great disconnect because it's like, oh, this is completely out of the normal understanding of science at that time.
Right.
And so I was sort of more or less cast as a heretic, or, you know, as like, you know, coming up with weird science that they just wanted to ignore. My colleagues really wanted to ignore it because it was an exception to this fundamental rule. So it's like, well, it's easier to ignore it than to pay any attention to it.
Right, so, that's sort of the standard route.
It is, you know, and it's interesting because you go back and you look at people that come up with stuff and then you realize at some point that they're all ostracized in the beginning as being totally weird. And then, you know, it turns out some of the things they come up with is like, oh, my God, it changes everything. And so the stuff that I came up with ultimately led, not me taking it that way, I already saw where it was going, and it led to what is today a new area of science that, and I say this, and it's very, very meaningful when I say it. It's not like I'm not trying to, you know, make a bigger statement, but this is how big the statement is.
Mm-hmm.
When the public becomes aware of the science that is now coming out about genes and all and how it works, there will be an evolution of human civilization, because what the new story of genes reveals is that genes don't determine the character of your life.
Right.
It turns out it's the character of your life that determines your genes.
Mm-hmm.
And why that becomes relevant is, our old belief, the one that's in the textbooks, is the belief you're a victim. And you say, what do you mean I'm a victim? And I say, well, look, genes control your life. And you say, yeah. And I said, did you pick your genes? It's like, well, not really. If you don't like the traits that you have in life, can you just go out and get some new genes? And the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't pick them. You can't change them. And, you know, according to the belief, they control your life. So we buy into, I'm a victim. You know, it's like running in my family. Cancer, cardiac disease, diabetes, all these things are like running in families. And then you feel like, oh, my God, you know, it's like I have this thought, I'm going to be in trouble. I've got these genes. And that's the old belief system. And now the new belief system says, no, genes are not in charge. It's actually the mind as a mechanism that interprets the environment and sends that information to the cells, controls it. In other words, the cells have to stay alive in an environment wherever they are. But to stay alive in the environment, you have to read the, you have to see what's going on.
Right, you got to have information from the environment. Yeah.
Right. So and when you get this information at the level of a single cell, there's in a cell there's something the equivalent of a brain.
Mm.
The cells are like miniature people, so it's interesting. The audience, we have to, you know, adjust some perceptions here. And let's adjust this perception so it will help us with the rest of the discussion. And here's a perception. Most people see themselves as a single entity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an illusion, because what we are is actually a community of over about like 50 trillion cells. It's the cells that are the living things. We are a community. So when you say, well, we, and your mind's going, you say, well, what does that represent, you know? And the thing is, that is the essentially like the government or the central voice, I call it, that all the cells are connected to, so that when you have a thought, essentially it's communicated to 50 trillion cells. And so in a real sense, if I could shrink you down real small to the size of a cell and stick you inside the human body, you look around and you say, it was just like home where I was a few minutes ago. Look, there are all these other cells which would be look like you, which are people, and there are all these people, and they got jobs, and everybody's doing everything, and at the level of the cell, if you were a cell, you couldn't see even yourself.
Right.
I mean, in a sense, it's sort of like be in the middle of Columbus, and then try to say, I can see the entire world. And the fact is, well, no, you can't. And that's like, well, a liver cell is inside the middle of your body. It's like, well, what's going on in the world? A liver cell is, man, all it looks around, it sees the liver cells around. It's like a town or a nation of liver cells. It can't see it. And then the important is, well, why should it see what's going on in the environment? The answer is, because life, to stay alive, an organism has to dynamically adjust its biology as the environment changes. So, for example, you walk outside and it's hot out. The moment the body temperature, the sensing of the temperature is that it's hot out, the body will then change the physiology and cause you to perspire and cool you down and keep you alive. And if you walk out and it's cold, well, the skin picks up and says, wait a minute, it's kind of cold, sends information in, which then turns up the heat in the body, gets you warmer. And the whole idea is this, what, you had to stay alive, yeah. And you had to adjust your biology, yeah, but what did you adjust it to? And the answer was the environment. I had to read the environment, and I adjusted it. Well, this plays out exactly at the same level of the cells. And the cells read the environment and then adjust their biology in a similar fashion to the way we do, to the world that we live in. So it's fun because at some real truthful level, what I saw in second grade, where I saw these cells as little people, it turns out, my God, our bodies are communities of trillions of cells, and it's the cells that are like live. They're the things that are doing all the work. They're the things that are making everything happen. And our distance from them, we don't see them. And the other part is, from their point of view, they can't see us as a large entity. They're, you know, it's just too big for them to see.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a funny relationship, and why it becomes important. Is one more fact about the cells, and then you'll see why it's important, and that is this. There's not one new function in your entire human body that's not already present in every single cell. Every system, like digestive, respiratory, nervous, excretory, reproductive, even an immune system, every one of those is present in every cell. So then there's a simple reality, and that is this. Cells are living entities. They have every function that you have. They're just very small. And the reality is, so then they're like little people. And the answer is yes. And why that becomes important is that here we are trying to survive on this planet with 6.5 billion people over the entire surface of this planet.
Right.
And under your skin are 50 trillion cells that live in a community with essentially a government, and they get paid.
They actually work it out. Yeah.
They got everything going. They got health care. They got a police department to make sure, like, the immune system. It's like, wait a minute. It's a real civilization with 2 million years of evolution that have created an opportunity, if you think about it, and you step back and say, in a happy, blissed-out human person, that would represent that inside that body of that human person were 50 trillion blissed out citizens. And all of a sudden you think, wow, man, you can get the whole community can be blissed out. It's like, yeah. And the issue is, they know about things that we in our world don't even know about. I mean, they have technologies in the body that humans can't even come near. I mean, they filter the air, the water, they manufacture things, they take care of the pollution. I mean, it's like the amazing technology.
Right.
And we have this human thing that anything that's not human is not intelligent. So, I mean, right away they question the intelligence of chimps and stuff like that. It's like, well, and then you try to say, well, how about the intelligence of cells? And they look at you like, what are you, crazy? And then you stop and then you just say, wait a second. The cell community that you're made out of is a technological community. They created technologies in handling an environment. I mean, that's how you carry water around you, and that water is continuously being purified and gassed and cleaned. I mean, we can't do that in our own world, you know? And the reality is, this is technology, and why the technology? Because it's not the things are not happening inside the cells as much of it is happening outside the cells.
Mm.
So in other words, the cells are altering their environment to create a technology that allows 50 trillion of them to live in harmony.
Amazing.
And so there's like, whoa. And then it's interesting because then you go back to that, there's this, you know, ancient saying that the answers you seek lie within.
Yeah.
Totally. And the answer is, oh my God, if we want to understand how to live in this world, we would take note of how the 50 trillion cells have a community. As I said, they all have jobs and they all get paid, but they don't get paid the same. The nerve cells get paid a lot more than a skin cell gets paid. But in the end, guess what? They all got food. They all got a place to sleep. They all have, you know, the environment taken care of. You know, the garbage is taken out on
some
a regular
dignity.
Basis. And the reality is, and in all of this stuff, if there's harmony in that community, then there's health in the system. And then the fact is, but when does ill health happen in the system? And that is when there's disharmony in the community. And the significance that we're finding out in the medical world now is that we've been blaming everything on the cells. You know, it's like, oh, you got a heart problem. Oh, you got bad cardiac cells.
Right,
you know, oh, you have diabetes. You got bad pancreatic cells in there. You know, and, oh, you got acid in your stomach. You got, these are bad cells. And it turns out that the cells are actually creating everything that the mind had in its image. And now some people probably out there in the radio land will say, what the hell is he talking about?
Yeah, that we're going to have to clarify that one a little bit.
And it basically comes down to this. The simple truth is my research, which started off showing environmental information in the Petri dish, is what was read by the cells, and that information was used to adjust the genetics and behavior of the cell.
And to change its function, essentially.
And change its function and everything. And so basically, it's a way so that the cells weren't like pre-programmed, that genes said, you're going to do this and you're going to do that. No, the genes are potentials, and that's what they represent.
Mm-hmm.
And with these potentials, you can create anything. And the significance about that is, what are you going to create? And the answer is, what are the cells seeing? They're going to try to make a complement to the environment that they're in. And that's what they're trying to do, is stay in balance. And so all of a sudden it says, then the cells must read the environment and adjust their biology. And then I said, well, yeah, but your liver cells, they're deep inside the middle of you. They can't read this. They can't see what's going on.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden you realize, yeah, and when you get 50 trillion cells together, you get one group of these cells, you give them the job. And the special job is to read the environment and send the interpretation to the self. That's called the mind and the brain. And its function is to do exactly that, is to read the environment so that you can adjust your biology and your behavior to stay alive. And why this becomes important is that our old beliefs, if something goes wrong with us, it was something mechanical and we have to take drugs and medicines and things like that to try to fix it. The new understanding is, no, you have to change your mind and your perceptions and your attitudes about life, because those are the responsible elements. So it's like, here are the interesting facts. 90% or more, and that's the big number now, 90% or more of cardiovascular disease is totally related to lifestyle, period. So it says, well, is there something wrong with your heart? And the answer is, yeah, now. Because if you hadn't paid attention that there are ways to handle stresses in your life, then you it's sort of like a teenager gets in the car for the first time and the parents are not there and is running down the street and, you know, hitting the brakes and then stepping on the accelerator, and then you realize at some point, boy, this car's not working well anymore. And it's like, was it the car's fault?
Yeah.
No, it's the driver.
Right.
And this is what medicine up until now has left out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
They left out the driver because they put the genes in as the control. So they said, no, your mind and your beliefs and your attitudes really don't have anything to do with it. It's just what the genes are. It's like a computer program that you got at the moment of conception. You push the button and there you are. The program unfolds and this is your life and these are the genes that are controlling your life. And it turns out, no. It doesn't really work that way, that the genes are always interactive with the environment, and that the environment uses the genes and programs life using the potentials of the genes. So let's say cancer. Recently, after 50 years of looking for a cancer gene, they haven't found a cancer gene.
Right.
And after 50 years, even the American Cancer Society just came out this last year and said, for the first time, and it's to me still an underestimate, they said 60% of cancer totally due to lifestyle.
Right.
So all of a sudden you start to realize, well, Jesus, you know, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and then here's a new one, diabetes.
Mm.
Totally lifestyle. And you know what's interesting? You can reverse it by changing lifestyle.
Huh.
And I said, just the audience, because if there are diabetics out there, let me give you a website. It's really great.
Yeah, please
it's
do.
Called Raw for 30 Days. And the number 30 is not written out. It's in numerals.
30, okay.
Raw for 30, the number 30days.com.
Raw for 30days.com. Is that what I think it is?
It is a raw food diet. They took 10 verified, certified, diabetic, insulin-dependent people, you know, that have been, you know, the medical doctors have said, that's it, man, this is your life forever. You must have all... You know, take this insulin, and this is your life.
Mm.
And they took these patients that were all certified, and they took them to a retreat center, and they all agreed that they would stay there for 30 days, and they had to eat a raw food diet. And it's fun because when you see this website, you can see the video.
Right.
And then on the video, you can see, like, after the first week, these people are just crazed, you know? I mean, they left their world of McDonald's and things like that, and here they are, and they were just the crankiest, angriest people because it was like, oh, man, this stuff is garbage and trash. And yeah, by the third week, their lives changed.
Mm.
And at the fourth week, after 30 days, not one of them was diabetic.
Amazing.
And then here comes the issue. When they went back home, 9 of them became diabetic again.
Right, jumped
only,
back.
Only one of them changed their lifestyle. The other ones just went right back into their life, and they got diabetic. And what was the point? The point was, we hear a story, a myth, like diabetes is this permanent thing and you got to deal with it with insulin and all that. And it turns out it's a lifestyle issue. And if you change it, you can change diabetes, you can, you know, change cardiovascular disease. All the issues that we really face as general diseases are really just stress-related consequences of driving a human body. And it's sort of like the body is a vehicle, and unfortunately, we didn't get a very good driver training with that vehicle, so people don't realize that their thoughts and beliefs and attitudes and emotions and their responses to life are feeding back into the biology and changing the environment, just like I put the cells in different environments to change their fate. So here's a simple, just like a conclusion to this section, is sort of what goes like this. It goes, I take the petri dishes with my stem cells in it, and I put them in a bad environment, meaning not a really supportive culture environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I leave them in there for a short time, and the cells start to get sick. You can actually physically see the cells. They get these big blebs and vesicles, and they look ugly, and they start dying. And then I say, no, take that dish and remove it from that bad environment, put it back over here into the good environment. And you put it back in the good environment, and all of a sudden the cells start to recover. They're healthy, they're flourishing, they're growing again.
Yeah, and they heal themselves.
Okay, now here's that. So you can see that that's what happened in the petri dish. And now all of a sudden we step back and I say, but recognize this about ourselves. We are skin-covered petri dishes.
Mm-hmm.
We have 50 trillion cells inoculated in the dish under our skin. And the simple point is, you take your petri dish and you put it in this environment over here, and it's not very supportive, the cells will get sick and die. And you take that that petri dish and move it back over here to this good environment, and we'll recover and become healthy. And that's, for example, you know, like the video on Raw for 30 days. Look, here are these people's vehicles in a very bad environment, and they're sick, and they're dying, and they're taking all the chemistry and insulin and stuff. And then you say, well, here, put them back into this healthy environment, and every one of them recovered and was no longer diabetic.
Remarkable.
So it's like, this is a new age coming, and the difference between the current age and the new age is the current age says, you're a victim, genes control your life, things go wrong, you didn't have anything to do with it, but we have drugs and chemistry and all this stuff that we can help you with.
Perhaps help you.
Perhaps.
Right?
And then what does the new life say? It says, if you understand the nature of how your thoughts and emotions and your behaviors are feeding back into the system and altering it, then you can start to recognize, well, then if you, you know, can control these and regulate these and rewrite programs that are not very supportive of you, then you change your health. And it's interesting because the symptoms, like cancer is a symptom, it's not the cause.
Right, right.
Or diabetes, it's a symptom. I said, well, no, it's not, the insulin's not working right. It's a symptom of what? Something else is going on. And the issue is that we cover up the symptoms in medicine. So, oh, good, I don't feel this anymore. I must be better, you know, or I'm taking all this Prozac, And guess what? You know, I used to be crazed, and now I'm sitting here like a lump, and I'm not crazed, but you know, I'm a lump.
Right, I'm not anything. Yeah.
And the idea is that there's always this effort that these chemistries are going to fix, and it turns out, okay, it turns out not only fix it, but on a fact, and this is a fact, medicine is the leading cause of death in the United States.
I know, and
that is because they're still based on an older version of the science, which is what I'm talking about now, is within the last 10 or 15 years. So it hasn't even, it's not in the textbook. So they're certainly not trained with it. And it says, look, the difference is they're still treating a vehicle as a machine that runs by genes. And the new medicine has to come in and say, wait, you are a participant. You're the driver of this vehicle, and you have responsibilities to this vehicle. And if you understand how to treat it and drive it, well, this vehicle lasts you, you know, more than 100 years, you know, 140, 150 years at least. And the reality is, no, not in the world the way we drive our vehicles. We destroy them. And it's a personal responsibility, and people don't want to hear that, especially after being given a whole life history of, you're not responsible for this, you're a victim. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, guess what? That was wrong, and we are responsible. And what it means is if you own the responsibility, then you can turn around and do something about it.
Right. Or not.
Well, that's a choice. And this is, you know, this whole world is coming to some big choices right away now. So that's why I'm so glad you gave me this opportunity to talk, because we have to give people an understanding that the science that is being taught, the conventional stuff in the textbooks, is wrong.
Yeah.
And it's being revised. But the problem is, revision is, the stuff I talk about, people that are doing research will say, so what's new? What are you talking about?
Right.
And then the people on the street, I talk about this, and they go, what did you say?
Huh.
And the thing is, the disconnect. Yes, the leading edge is understanding these new things. The teaching, academic, the repeated year after year coursework, books and stuff like that, still telling the old
so
story.
Right.
And it's very important, because if perception controls biology, which it does in the nature of the book that I wrote, then it says, you know, positive perceptions about life and understanding of how it works will support your survival, and misperceptions, where you misinterpret the environment, threaten your life. Here's an example of perception controlling biology is, many people are familiar with anorexic people, you know, that just keep starving themselves. So we were in a group and there was an anorexic person, and we look at this person and we say, oh my God, that person's like skin and bones, they're going to die. And then we ask this person, we say, well, when you look in the mirror, what do you see? And when they look in the mirror, they say, no, I see this overweight, you know, grotesque, weighty person.
Right, that's amazing.
And the issue is, so they have a perception, and their biology, which is reading this perception, and the mind is saying, this is overweight. The biology says, oh, well, then we'll reduce the weight. So the idea is, do the liver cells see how big the body is? No, they're just taking the interpretation from the brain. So the point about it is, the cells themselves can't see that the thing is dying, and yet the information is coming down from the top. You got to get rid of more weight.
And the issue was,
so what was wrong with the anorexic? The answer was, actually, physiologically, nothing. What was wrong was, there was a misperception the way this person sees life or themselves, and this misperception is translated into the biology, and then that leads to the death.
Amazing.
And so the bottom line says, your perceptions are feeding back to your biology, and so your beliefs and attitudes shape your biology. And this becomes the key to life, where it says this, look, if genes controlled your life, I said, you have to go change your genes. And that's like, well, that's not going to happen. And then I said, yeah, but perception controls your life. And then when you say, well, you mean if I change my perception? And the answer is, that's what we have to do, and that's doable. And why that's the freedom part. Because if it was genes, it had nothing to do with you, you're a victim,
right.
You have to have somebody else fix it. When we know it's perception, then all of a sudden we have, wait, that's something I can do about it. It's like, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can have power, but you have to own the belief, and the belief is a very important issue, because it's the mind is programmed with so-called beliefs, And some of these beliefs are right, and some of them are wrong. And if they're wrong, do the cells know they're wrong? Like the anorexic, do the cells know that the system is dying? Well, not, you know, as I said, they're limited vision. They can't see but what's around them. They don't see what's going on. They're taking the word from the top.
Amazing. Yeah. All right, look, let's take a little break here, okay?
Yeah.
All right, wonderful stuff, Bruce. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Everybody, Dr. Bruce Lipton. We'll be back with Bruce in just a few minutes. Our guest is Dr. Bruce Lipton, and you can find information about Bruce on his website at BruceLipton, L-I-P-T-O-N, .com. Let's get right back to Mr. Bruce and say hello.
Hello again.
Hey, a couple things came up at the break there, Bruce.
Yeah.
First of all, somebody who's read your book obviously asked if you would talk a little bit about the science of epigenetics. And I sort of think we already have been, but maybe you can clarify that there's actually a scientific term for this stuff now.
Okay, well, you know, the last discussion was really talking about the fact how environment was influencing the genes, and that was stuff that I found in the 1970s. And about 10 years ago, research, understanding this pathway, which was done by lots and lots of people all over the place, led to an understanding of the mechanism of how environment signals alter genes in the chromosomes. And why this became important is because it released us from the belief that genes were self-actualizing, that genes turned themselves on and turned themselves off. Mm-hmm. So people always say that, oh, a gene turned on and a gene turned off. And it's built into our belief system. It's like, well, you know, I say, well, people, obviously you have some idea in your head about genes and how things work. And it really turns out, no, it basically there's something called a gene, and it's like a, you know, something is, you know, it programs something or other, and then it turns on and off, and then things happen, and that's been our belief, and so we gave genes an ability to make responses on their own, like a gene turning on, a cancer gene turning on. People talk about that.
Right.
The new biology revealed that's totally there's no such thing as that, and here's the reason why. A gene, an all honest, straightforward description, is a blueprint to make a protein molecule. The proteins are the building blocks of your body that give your structure and function. So the genes are the blueprints. They're actually just like a long strip of coded letters, and they tell you how to make a protein. And why that's important is it's just a blueprint. And yet we've given it like extraordinary, you know, like powers of turning itself on and off. And the joke is, well, wait a minute. Let's say you go into an architect's office and you lean over her shoulder while she's drawing her blueprint, and you ask her and you say, excuse me, is this blueprint on or off? Yeah, you know, exactly. They look at you, what are you, nuts? You know, it's like, there's no on and off, it's a blueprint.
Yeah,
it's
and
like,
can the blueprint build the building, you know, basically by itself? Yeah.
Well, that's, if you believe that genes control life and the story we told people, that would be what it would amount to. That would mean that you just activated the blueprint, and the next thing there was a body right there.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
And it's like, well, the truth is, the humor of it is, well, that doesn't make any sense. And the answer is, right. We bought it because it was a misperception. It was just, they thought they knew the answers, and they jumped to the conclusion without really, you know, going into it. And the belief about genes controlling life was the joke about it. It was never a scientific fact.
Mm.
It was something that they thought would. They thought that's what how it worked, and they got some initial insights that it looked like, oh, it's looking like just the way we thought it did. So they created the belief called it's funny because it's called in the science. It's called the central dogma.
Right.
And the joke about it is, of course, is. The dogma, by its definition, means a belief based on religion, not science.
I know. The fact that they even use that word is remarkable.
Well, that's the surprising part. And here's the joke, that it actually was a belief based on their personal persuasion, be it a scientific religion, but it was their persuasion.
Mm.
They bought that belief before they actually had the science, because they said, oh, we can see where it's going. So they guessed it, and then here's the point. When it first came out into the science, it was actually called a hypothesis. Like, this is an idea, hypothesis. But that was in 1958. And it seems so right that they kept repeating it, and then 1958 turned to 1959, and 1970, 80, 90, 2000. Here's the point. The belief has been repeated for 50 years.
Right.
Yet we forgot about 40-some years ago that it was just an idea, a hypothesis. It was repeated so frequently that nobody questioned it. It was sort of like, of course, genes control life. That's the way it is. You know, it's like, wait a minute. Where was that science? The answer was,
you know,
it wasn't there.
You know, Bruce, I think of the word meme, you know, and the way a meme moves through a culture, and it's sort of like a gene almost, because that's sort of like what we're talking about. In other words, we have this meme that was introduced 50 years ago, the idea that genes control everything, and once the meme gets loose, you know, it sort of lives its own life out there, and until another meme that can come along that can knock it off, sort of.
Exactly, and the interesting thing about this is that the current science actually gives a scientific foundation to a meme, a real understanding that a meme does exist, a thought, a perception, which these perceptions can change your genes. So all of a sudden it's like, wow, the fact that an idea can rewrite your genes, and the answer is absolutely.
Amazing.
Because these are perceptions. So all of a sudden it's like, well, what is epigenetics? Epigenetics is a science that says, how does a gene work? And the answer is, well, it's a blueprint number one. And the question is, well, what do you do with blueprints? You read them. So how does it work? And the answer is, when the cell needs something, it selects a blueprint from the nucleus, and it's like the nucleus is like a drawer with patterns in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need something and you have to say, geez, I need to make something like one of these, you go to the pattern drawer and you say, yeah, I'd like that pattern, and then that pattern is copied, and then you use that pattern to make your protein. So the original pattern is DNA, the copy pattern is called RNA, and from the copy pattern you make the protein, which is the building block of the body.
Right.
So that this whole transition is based on reading the DNA, and we had said like the DNA reads itself. That was like genes decided to do this, and it's like, no, blueprints don't decide to do anything. You have to read the blueprint. Then you say, well, who reads the blueprint? And the answer is, the contractor, the one who's going to build something. And I said, yeah, but then in the body, the blueprints of the DNA, who's the contractor? All of a sudden we return back to the fact that it's the mind which is interpreting the environment, that's building something to survive in that environment. So the mind is the interface, and epigenetics is the molecular mechanism by which signals, like from the mind, go into the DNA and read the DNA blueprints to create the body, and then all of a sudden what we found about epigenetics that like was the most amazing thing was that the signals that are like the ones that select the genes to be read, well, these signals can alter the reading of the gene to this degree. This is like a mind-numbing thought when you put together that every gene blueprint, using these epigenetic mechanisms to read them, you can create over 30,000 different protein products from the same blueprint.
Wow.
And all of a sudden I say, well, wait a minute, you know, it was like a gene makes something. It's like, no, a gene is a potential, and the contractor can alter that potential to make 30,000 variations of every gene. And why that all of a sudden becomes important is like, so where are the limitations? And the answer is, there aren't really any limitations. And here's the problem, though.
Bruce, why are T cells different then?
Why aren't which cells?
Why are stem cells different then?
Well, stem cells are unique in this regard. When cells first got together in evolution, there was like 3.5 billion years where there were only single cells, and they just like it was just like an aquarium with single cells. That's all it was on this planet. And about 700 million years ago, cells got a new idea. They said, you know, if we come together in a group and hang out in a group, that we could be more successful in a group, you know. And it's funny because it's the concept of two can live as cheaply as one. When cells started to group up in a community, it was more efficient to live in the community. And at the beginning, the communities were only like hundreds or maybe a thousand cells, just a, you know, group of cells in a community. And every cell did the same thing. It was sort of like when first human civilizations, they were like hunter-gatherers, right? So this tribe of people would walk across. Everybody would do the hunting and all the chores because they're a small group. Everybody did everything. But when the cell numbers in the community started to get bigger and bigger, there was a point. It wasn't very efficient to for everybody to do the same work. So some cells say, "Well, look, I'll tell you what. I'll do digestion, and you do muscle work over here, and you over there, you do respiration." And so what happened is, in the community of cells, cells started to take on specialized traits of different jobs. They were like jobs, actually.
Right.
You know, like, I'm going to be a heart cell. That's my job.
Right.
And the issue is this. Originally, they all came from a cell that could be anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is, when our bodies are being formed and a lot of the cells are turning into all the different tissues and organs of the body, a special number of these cells hang out and don't follow through. They don't take a job. And what do these cells?
I know some friends like that.
Yeah, but the difference is that these cells, when they get called upon, then they really have to go to work at that point. You know, the issue is, a stem cell is a cell that doesn't take on a specialization, has the potential to become a large number of different things. So therefore, serves as utility cells needed to replace aging or dying cells so to keep the body alive. So, I mean, for example, when I talk about people, I talk about growth, and people think, "Oh, growth is like from a baby to an adult." And I say, "No, you got it wrong. Growth is every day for the rest of your life, for a simple reason, because every day you lose billions and billions of your cells through death. Like your skin cells keep sloughing off, and the digestive lining that gets the lining of the digestive tract gets replaced every 3 days.
Amazing.
And all of a sudden you say, "Well, wait." You got a lot of turnover here. Where are you getting the new replacements? And the answer, stem cells. So stem cells are a special population. Their function is to be all around the body, positioned so that when anything needs to be replaced or fixed, then the stem cell's job is to, in the scientific term, is called differentiate, meaning take on a special trait,
right,
and then repair that tissue or organ. Using fresh, brand new cells.
Amazing.
And all of us have these stem cells throughout our body, and then comes the little joke from the inside department, me here laughing for this reason, is that, well, then if we all have stem cells, I guess God didn't give us a way to use them, because obviously we're paying billions of dollars to the pharmaceutical company to figure out how to use them. And the thing is, that's the joke. It's sort of like, if you have stem cells, well, you know, of course we know how to use them. And then you have to ask the question, yeah, but how come if I have stem cells and I have an injury and it's not working right, or I'm not repairing my tissues fast enough, you know, why am I sick? And then all of a sudden you say, well, you know, that's where the medical people say, well, if anything's wrong, must be something wrong with the genes. And so that's why the pharmaceutical company's trying to mess with the cells to try to figure out how to get them started. And it turns out, wait, no, the system makes what is called for.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you say, yeah, but you know, if I'm not repairing this, are you trying to say that I am not, that I am denying my own healing? You know, I'm involved with, of course I want to get healed. And the point is, the stem cells take the commands from the mind, and the mind has two parts to it. And there's the conscious part, the part we think with our personal identities. You know, you're Mike, I'm Bruce. We got different personal identities and all that. That's the conscious mind. And then there's this bigger part of the mind, which is essentially almost the whole brain, which is called the subconscious part, meaning that it does the operations without us paying attention, automatic. You don't have to think about your breathing. It does it automatically. When you get up and walk, all you have to have is an intention of where you want to go. The subconscious will do all the manipulations and nerve firing to make you get there. You don't see it, okay? So here's the point. Your personal desires and wishes and wants, what you want from your life, come from your conscious mind, right? Which, you know, I say, what do you want? And then you consciously telling me I want these things.
Right.
And I say, yeah, cool. And I say, and you also have this other mind called the subconscious mind, and the issue is, what does that one want? And you say, well, you know, you would think, well, it wants what I want. And the answer is, no. And here's the issue. The primary programs in our subconscious minds, and that's everybody out there that's listening, folks, the primary programs in our subconscious mind were downloaded by observing others. And therefore, the programs that are in your subconscious mind may in no way support what you want because they're emulating the behavior of other people. And then all of a sudden you say, wow, you mean I could have a subconscious mind that could be antagonistic to where I want to go? And the answer is, most likely everybody is because it was programmed from our culture and our parents' behaviors and all that. And then here comes the stickler. Yes, your conscious mind is the one that you have all your dreams and wishes on, but the subconscious mind is 1 million times more powerful and operates 95% of the day. And all of a sudden you say, wait a minute, let me get this straight. 5% of the day I operate from my personal desires and wishes and wants from life, and 95% of the day I operate from the automatic behaviors.
Hmm.
I say, absolutely. And then I said, but your principal automatic behaviors were programmed before you were six. Okay? So now I go back and we say, wait, let's go back to a five-year-old, okay? And we say that, and this is a standard case, it's a very, very common situation everywhere, that this five-year-old doesn't really get a lot of attention from their parents, but if they get sick, all of a sudden they get lavished attention and love, and everybody takes care of this kid, right?
Right.
This kid at that age is just downloading stuff into the subconscious mind. It's actually... The conscious mind is not really even working at that until after six.
Right.
So this child is downloading just the observations, and the observations are logic. It says, when I am sick, I get a lot of love. Okay? And then now you're 40 years old, and you're out there, and your conscious mind is saying, man, I got a lot of things to do and all this stuff, and your subconscious mind's looking around 95% of the day saying, I'm not really getting all the love I want, but I know how to get it.
Right.
And the subconscious mind's automatic. It doesn't think. It just says, oh, you want love. It goes to the file. The file says, you get love when, and then they open the drawer, and the file says, when you're sick. And all of a sudden the mind says, oh, well, then all you need to do is get sick, and then you're going to get this love.
Hmm.
And then people are, and this is important, I have to then emphasize this. That's not what the conscious mind desire was.
Right.
That was the kid in before six program in the subconscious mind. So I'm not saying people are out there saying, man, I'm really looking forward to getting sick so I can get some love. That's not what the conscious mind is saying. That's just a stimulus response program that the child picked up. But since that's the mind that works 95% of the day, that's the mind that's more likely to shape the expression of the cells. So that we have to start recognizing, my goodness, then that my life may not be going where I want it to go, not because I'm a victim and the world's against me. It may not be going where you want it to go because 95% of the day you're not operating from the mind that has those desires and intentions where you want to go. You're operating from the other one, which is for the first 6 years of your life, and this is in the book, it's factual understanding. The first 6 years of a child's life, they're in a hypnotic trance, essentially. They're just downloading data by observing the world. They're just like television recording cameras, recording everything, putting it into the subconscious mind. But there's a reason why, so it's not like, well, that's a stupid idea or something. Here's the reason why. The conscious mind's function is thinking and reasoning and logic, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you have no data in the computer, and I say, so what are you going to think about? You're going to say, well, there's nothing in the computer. what are you going to reason about? Well, mm-hmm. I have nothing in the computer. So nature set up the first 6 years of our lives as a download. We download data. And the conscious mind, as an EEG activity, we're reading the brain activity, the conscious mind doesn't really kick in until about six or after. Meaning, the first to the machine so that when you get to be six and the conscious mind starts to kick in, the conscious mind has data to think about. Right. Otherwise, it's an empty slate.
That's amazing. You know, I have a four-year-old son and a one-year-old, but my four-year-old right now, you know, I really see that, you know, in an experiential sense right now.
Well, he's, you know, and here's the issue. You think, well, he's taking attention when I'm talking to him, which he is, but you don't realize this. When you walk away, he's still videotaping you.
Right.
And every movement and everything you do is already downloaded. So an issue is, well, this is a problem with parents, because sometimes parents think, well, oh, I'm, you know, they have, you know, maybe nasty behaviors. But then around the kid, they say, you know, like, all of a sudden they're really nice to the kid. But when they turn their back on the kid and have nasty behaviors to other people, that's still being recorded.
Right, right.
And the child will emulate the parent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I said, look, here's the issue. 5% of the day you operate from the mind with your desires and your tensions, and 95% of the day you operate from the mind that's the programs, okay?
Right.
And the issue about this is that we don't see the subconscious programs operate generally. Sometimes you see yourself caught up and you all of a sudden observe yourself doing like, wow, what kind of behavior am I doing? You know, it's like, it was surprises you. Where the hell did that come from? This is important for us to understand for this reason. The subconscious mind's job is to do all of the functions that are not being looked after by the conscious mind. Meaning, it could be simple things like breathing, making a heartbeat, or driving the car.
Mm-hmm.
For example, once you learn how to drive, the program is in the subconscious mind. It went through all the driver training, downloaded all the programs, so that if you get in a car and you have a conversation with somebody, you get so deeply involved in that conversation, and all of a sudden you sheepishly look out the window and realize, you know, I haven't paid attention to the road the last 10 minutes. You're surprised yourself.
It's weird, actually. I've had that. I'm sure many of us have had that happen.
Well, that's why I like to use it, because this is an important lesson, and it says very simply this. Your conscious mind was engaged in the conversation, so who was driving the car?
Right.
And the answer was the subconscious mind. Why? Because you weren't paying attention.
then the road was curving, and there's signs.
And you didn't hit anything, apparently.
Right.
So, you know,
right.
It worked pretty good.
Amazing.
And yet, you have to look at it this way. As a matter of fact, it works better in driving the car than your conscious mind, because the subconscious mind, as an information processor, is a million times more powerful anyway.
Wow.
And matter of fact, if you're about to get into an accident, the nervous system will shut down your conscious mind and put you on automatic subconscious behavior because it's faster.
I've had that happen too.
Okay.
All right, we got to take a break, Bruce, okay?
Right.
Let's do that, and we'll come back and we'll continue.
Let's meet here again.
Okay, we'll be back in just a minute, all right? Everybody, it's Bruce Lipton on the web at brucelipton.com. He has a wonderful book that's called The Biology of Belief. And, Bruce, are you writing anything else right now? Do you have a follow-up for that?
Yeah, I am trying to put together a new book, which is really based on when you understand the nature of how cells work and the nature of cellular communities, they provide a lot of insight in about the evolution of humanity. And right now, this is, like, so exciting. It depends on what your perception is, because you look outside and you say, oh, my God, things are, like, really weird going on out here. This world's shaking a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the thing is, it is shaking, but there's a reason behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And while everybody's focusing on the darkness, what the biology reveals is there's something bigger and greater beyond all this, and we have to go through this to get to the other side. So for me, it's like, wow, it's really exciting. I'm not caught up in the... I could see where it's going down, but I also know where it's going to, and it's like the most exciting destination. So people should realize that it might look scary, but it's going to be an interesting ride, and there's an outcome that is spectacular.
All right. Okay, good. We'll be back in just a minute. Okay, Bruce?
Right.
It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Dr. Bruce Lipton on the web at brucelipton.com. We'll get right back to, I was going to say Dr. Lipton, but I promised him I wouldn't. We'll get right back to Bruce and say hello again. Hey, Bruce, where are you at right now?
Santa Cruz, California.
Santa Cruz. Okay, so it's just a little after 11 o'clock.
Yes, it is, and it's a California world out here, which having started out on the East Coast and lived in the Midwest and in the South, kept going west, and now I'm at the edge.
All right. Well, Santa Cruz is a great town, too. I know the guys that make snowboards there.
it's a fun kind of place, actually.
All right. Let's see. I have a question with regard to the word symbiosis. This seems to be something that is directly related to almost everything that we've been talking about. And I thought about it, of course, when you talk about this amazing community of cells that we have that make up our bodies. And, of course, then on a fractal level, you can move upward to the organs that all work together and then individual people in communities and this sort of thing. But maybe you could talk about symbiosis and how important this is in this whole idea.
Well, I don't know if you're talking about the fact, perhaps, about the bacteria and all the other organisms that live inside of us.
Sure, sure.
Well, this is really a very interesting topic because we've been groomed in a civilization where you say the word bacteria and everybody goes, germs!
Right. Antibacteria, kill it all.
Destroying, throw stuff on them, kill them. And it turns out that if it wasn't for bacteria, we would be dead right away. Is because they're fundamental to our digestive system and maintenance of our biology. That they're the normal living bacteria. There are more bacteria in us than we have human cells, and they are part of the community that we actually protect them. We make secretions that get rid of toxic bacteria and encourage the growth of the good bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
That these bacteria actually even influence us because the secretions from the bacteria change the genetic readout of our gut lining cells.
Right, and again, they change the environment of those cells.
They change the environment. The gut cells respond by changing their behavior, and so there's a symbiosis between the bacteria and the gut and the organisms there, and we need them for getting certain factors like vitamins into our system. That there are certain vitamins that we don't make or absorb without the help of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out, it says, wait a minute, having bacteria is required for life, and yet we live in a world where we have bought into the belief that bacteria are bad and evil, and we take antibacterials, antibiotics, routinely. And people don't realize, my God, you don't realize what you're doing yet. You might be trying to stem off some bad bacteria, but the problem is, when you take bacteria antibiotics, you don't discriminate.
No, you're wiping them all out.
You're wiping them all out, and this becomes a very serious problem because then it alters our ability to digest our food and get nourishment and even get vitamins into the system. And in the world we live in today, with such a push for hygienic and environments to spray everything down with antiseptics and do all this stuff, that we are killing off a lot of the bacteria in our system that are required for a healthy body. So it's very interesting that what should really be put on a lot of people's lists, especially people who have been through bouts using antibiotics, is to reinstall healthy bacteria into the system.
Right.
And so they're called probiotics.
Yes.
And these are things that increase the important bacteria that are necessary in our gut. And it's interesting because this also now relates to something about genetically modified foods that people don't know about. And that is, it's been recognized that when bacteria digest things, they also capture the DNA from some of the things that they digest.
Mm-hmm.
It's nature's plan. It's like, somebody made this information, the bacteria reads it and says, well, this could be useful.
Right,
it doesn't just destroy
that.
It. So
sure.
We now, there's data to reveal that in genetically modified foods, when digested in our gut, the bacteria pick up the genetically engineered genes.
Mm.
And if this alters that bacterial population, which in turn then responds, our genes are selected by the action of the bacteria as well.
Right.
And all of a sudden you start to say, oh my God, we're dabbling with something we have no idea about. And this has been the big surprise of genetic engineering, because a conventional belief we've held for a long, long time is that, when an organism dies, the DNA just, dies and, melts that way or whatever it does, it degenerates and turns into stuff.
Right.
And it turns out it does not. That, in fact, organisms that, especially the microorganisms, which eat up all the dead things anyway,
right,
take the DNA and pass it among themselves. So when they planted genetically modified crops, they started to find that the weeds and all the other things around the crops started to pick up the genes from the genetic engineering, made them resistant to herbicides, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And this is called a, these are called transfers. There's a horizontal or lateral transfers, meaning that the DNA is passed from similar species to similar species. But now there's information that there's vertical transfer, so that humans in our genomes actually have genes acquired from bacteria. So all of a sudden, the vision that, oh, you can just grow anything you want, when it dies, that's gone, turns out that once you put things out in the environment, we are beginning to know the reality that we've been told but haven't really want to own, and that is the entire biosphere is one living community.
Right.
And all this information is being spread around, so that when we alter something in the environment like that, it goes through like waves through the environment. So we've been a little hasty, you know, into this whole genetic engineering thing, and it's sort of, to me, it's an unfortunate situation, is that here they are trying to engineer genes when they didn't even know how they worked, and now since the Human Genome Project comes out, it totally blew away all the beliefs that we had about genes. The results of the project undermined the entire foundation of our belief system.
Talk a little bit more about that, about where, in other words, and that's probably why we don't hear so much about the Human Genome Project anymore, because for a while it was all the rave, and then all of a sudden
they were
going to
cure everything. They were going to find a gene that caused every stupid thing in your body. You know, they're going to say, once we got these genes, you tell me what your problem is. I have a gene I'm going to engineer and get rid of your problem.
Right.
That was a belief system, because when they went into the project, the belief was, genes are blueprints, and that's true. They are blueprints, okay? But their belief was that these blueprints, they would require more and more genes as you go from primitive organisms to more complex organisms,
right,
because the traits of more complex organisms, obviously you must have more genes to handle all these traits.
Right.
So they saw like a scale that as you started from the primitive organism, by the time you got to the humans, you would have to have about 150,000 genes as a minimum number to make a human being. So calculated on a machine where genes are blueprints and, you know, it like programs in a computer, and their belief of how it worked, there had to be at least 150,000 genes. And the results of the project a couple of years ago when they came in revealed that we only have about 23,000 genes. And so all of a sudden it says, wait a minute, the beliefs of biology that once said you needed 150,000 genes now have to be completely altered to say, well, how did you make something as complex as a human being with 23,000 genes? And this is the same number of genes found in some of the smallest animals on this planet, like a worm. Like there's this worm that has 1,271 cells. It's so small you can hardly see it. And it's got the same number of genes as a human.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it says, wait, that whole belief that there are going to be a lot more genes because of how genes are going to make humans more complex and simple organisms, turns out, no, we have the same number of genes as a simple organism.
Amazing, yeah.
And all of a sudden it says, well, then we have to go back and rethink how it works, because obviously it didn't work the way we thought it did, because there's 125,000 genes that are missing. And it's fun because they had great hoopla. Oh, the Human Genome Project is done. Well, true, it was done.
Yeah.
And it succeeded, because its mission was identify all the genes in the human genome. And so they were, you know, obviously correctly and appropriately applauding the reality that they did the human genome, and they did find every gene in the human genome. What they didn't really talk about was the missing 125,000 genes.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the end
of their paradigm.
It says that your belief system doesn't work because there aren't that many genes, so you must have another belief system to put in place, because the existing one doesn't work. And that's where epigenetics comes back in. It's like, oh yeah, with your ability to make all the variations on genes, guess what? There are no limitations for any. You can make anything with your genes. And most people are actually missing genes. Most everybody out there that's listening is missing. They're missing genes. And then you say, but well, I feel perfectly normal and fine. The answer is because of epigenetics. You can rewrite another gene to compensate for a missing gene.
Right.
And all of a sudden it's like there are not these rigid limitations that the old theory of genetics had, that these are your programs and this is your life, and the new one is, no, these are your potentials and you can create your life.
So the question then becomes, obviously, the how-to. If we know that the human body combined with the human mind, and of course we were talking about symbiosis for a few minutes, there has to be a symbiotic relationship between the organs of the body. In other words, the brain, you know, is the brain, but it's, on the one hand, it's just another organ that's a part of a team, and it has to be in right relation to the other organs of the body. And apparently once we get these things in right relation, then, like you say, almost anything is possible. So the question becomes then, how do we get into that situation?
Well, it's interesting because if you look at the organs, every organ is like a nation on this planet.
Right.
It's an independent system. Every organ can operate without the brain. A lot of people think the brain makes things happen.
Right.
No, every organ makes things happen. The function of the brain is like a conductor.
Right, to coordinate things.
It just coordinates them. It doesn't make your heart beat. That's why when the heart is removed from a living person, it's still beating.
Right.
Because it has its own nervous system. The digestive tract has its own nervous system. You can dissect out from your gullet all the way down to your anus, take out the entire digestive system out of the body, put an apple in at the gullet side, and a short time later, you'll get the remains coming out the other end with no nervous system connected to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Remarkable.
So what it says is that what happened was it was a cooperative trade-off, that every organ system contributed a function and in exchange got back things that it could use to sustain its life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the heart will say, look, my job is I'll beat this thing and make the blood, and my job is to push this blood around. But since I'm going to spend my time doing that, I really don't have time to do the work of the digestive system and respiration. So I'll tell you what, the lungs, you do the respiration stuff, you know, and you purify this air for me, and I'll do the pumping of the blood for you. It was a business. It was it was interesting. It was like the organs of the body were like guilds that had different functions that came together and said, look, if we cooperate, we can make this thing work.
Like an alliance of sorts.
Exactly. And this is exactly where the world is bound to go, even though people don't see what, you know, a lot of people are like actually terrified of that concept. But the world will exist where it's one living organism, and every nation is the equivalent of an organ.
Mm.
In this operation with the exchange and the communication and the harmony, and this is where we're going, and this is obviously not where we are.
Right.
In other words, each
particular part of the planet, perhaps doing what they do best.
Absolutely. I mean, for example, while we're obviously cutting down all the rainforest, that's the same as go into your body and cut your lungs out.
Right.
And you say, well, why would I do that? And that's really my question about the rainforest issue. And yet why it's important is because what do those people that are out in Brazil have to do to support the world economy? And the answer is maintain the rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, they were doing that until we went in there and destroyed it anyway. But the reality was, so you say, well, they don't have to make computers and, you know, have assembly lines. They have to make sure that their rainforest is functioning in clearing the air of this planet that's being polluted by all the other ones.
Right.
And yet there'll be an exchange for that, because it's interesting that biology takes care of a lot of things for us that when it doesn't work, we're going to have to pay for them. So, for example, biology cleans the air, takes the pollution out, you know, balances the gases, and does all these things. And as we just start to destroy the normal biology that provides for those functions, then we actually have to pay a technology to make those functions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because when you realize that the amount of technology it would take to replace a rainforest, for example, is like, you can't afford that.
Right.
It's cheaper to pay the Indians to stay there and keep the rainforest and take care of it than for us to buy the technology to fix the air if we don't have the rainforest.
Right.
As a matter of fact, we won't be able to do it anyway.
Oh, so. I know. It's another one of these, you know, the technological fixes so oftentimes become more problematic than the problem they were trying to fix. And I think most times, perhaps not because intention isn't good, but because, you know, there's confusion and they don't have clarity on the actual nature of the issue, and they try to solve a problem when they don't understand the problem.
Well, this is the same thing why medicine has become a leading cause of death, and it's the same thing going out in the world that you just said, and it goes like this. In medicine, for example, in biology, you take something apart, and then you line up all the pieces, and you say, this is, you know, piece A operates piece B that hits piece C. It's like a flow chart. And then you say, so you have like A goes to B, goes to C, goes to D, and then you say, oh, in this disease, C isn't working right. So you get the pharmaceutical company, and they make a new part, C, so that when you go back in the body, A goes to B, and then you put the drug in, that's the new C, which then makes it go to D.
Right.
And this is the intention of a design in a drug, but here's the problem, and the problem that also underlies what you were talking about, and that is this, is that the system is an integrated, entangled network. It's like a mesh. And the significance is there is no linear A goes to B goes to C. Everything is connected to everything else. So if you alter one thing, you didn't alter just one thing. You say, look, I want to make a drug to affect this. So you make a drug and you get some effect on that thing you were talking about.
Mm.
And then you have 5 pages of small little print that says, well, you know, when you take this drug and you can have, you know, like, you know, coronary problems, and you could die, or you know, these are the 5 pages of script,
right,
which are called side effects.
Side effects, yeah.
And the truth is, when you understand the nature of the biology, these are not
no
side
such
effects.
Thing as
they're
side
direct
effect.
Effects right. of yanking on a net and pulling one piece of the net, but you pull all the rest of the net as well. You can't just touch one piece; all of it's connected. And so, when we try to fix a problem in the world, this is the focus of the problem. Then you it's like adding a drug. So I fixed this little problem, yeah, but now you didn't see all the connections with everything else,
mm-hmm.
and now that one little problem is now turned into these other problems, and this is where the technology has failed us, because we have always perceived a biology as like an assembly line. Everything's on an assembly line, so A goes to B goes to C, and that you could adjust just one piece of the assembly line and you could fix anything, but now it turns out, no, it's an entangled network. Everybody's influencing everybody else. So if you alter one, you altered all the rest too.
Just like the quantum physics ideas.
This is where it actually comes. Is coming back into it, because the medicine is based on Newtonian physics, the outdated idea. So that's the linear: A goes to B goes to C. And quantum physics is the new physics. It's not that new. It's 100 years old, essentially. That physics has said, there is no linear A goes to B. Everything is interconnected, you know. For a visual picture of it, I actually haven't made the slide, but I was really going to do it. Remember that Jell-O? You used to put fruit in, you know, like, and float fruit in the Jell-O?
Sure.
And if you would, like, you know, take a pair of tweezers and try to grab, let's say, like a piece of, you know, like a grape in there, right? If you try to pull the grape out, you'll start to realize, even though all the other fruit isn't connected, when you start to pull on it, you cause all the other fruit to shake in that
thing. It's moving, yeah.
And this is the way the environment is. Everything is connected to everything else, but we've never seen it that way. And yet, the result of our world and the way it's turning out is a consequence of not seeing it that way.
Right.
And that's why we try to fix one part, and then we get, in medicine they would call it a side effect. Oh, look, yeah, you tried to adjust this, and now the environment is altered in this way. That's a side effect.
Right.
It's like, no, everything's connected, and that's our failure of our misunderstanding of looking at everything in a Newtonian fashion, because the world is not Newtonian. The world is based on quantum physics, and all of a sudden people are saying, oh, here we go with that stuff again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, because basically the word physics is mechanics. They're the same word. So you can say quantum physics or quantum mechanics.
Yes.
Newtonian physics, Newtonian mechanics. The interesting fact is, what does physics mean? And basically it is the mechanism of why things occur. And this becomes very important, because if you don't understand the mechanisms and you try to fix something,
uh-huh.
then you're more likely to create a big problem. And this is the problem with medicine. They look at the body on the physics of Newton, which is based on matter. That's why medicine uses drugs and chemistry. And tries to understand the nature of the body as a machine made out of matter. And yet the basic mechanisms of life are quantum physics,
mm.
which say, no, it's the energy the invisible stuff that gives shape to the matter. And since you haven't looked at that, then you don't understand where the problems in matter are. And that's why medicine is failing, because here's an analogy so people can put this picture in their head and see what I'm talking about. It goes like this. Imagine I take a bunch of iron filings, they look like sand grains, and I sprinkle them on a piece of paper. They just randomly fall all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, before I sprinkle it this time, I put a magnet under the paper. And when I put a magnet on the paper, then I sprinkle the iron filings. They don't fall randomly. They create that, you know, that magnetic field shape, you know. Now, the interesting thing is this. Imagine you didn't know about the magnet. You don't know anything about magnets, right? You don't see it. You don't know it's there. It's under the paper. You don't even know it's there, right?
Right.
And I sprinkle the iron filings, and they always form this beautiful pattern. And then you want to be a scientist, and you want to say, geez, I wonder, where does that pattern come from? So what do? You study the iron filings, and you take them apart, and you look at them, and you try to understand their chemistry and everything, and try to figure out, where the heck did the pattern come from? Must be in these iron filings. And the point was, the filings didn't have a pattern in them.
Mm.
It was, they were conforming to the invisible magnetic field.
Yeah.
Well, if you can't see the field, and if you don't know the magnet's there, then it's not part of your understanding. So you try to understand the iron filings. Why do they form the pattern? And the answer is, you'll never figure out the answer, okay? The idea is this. If you study the iron filings and don't recognize the pattern, that's called Newtonian physics. You study the matter. You don't study the invisible stuff.
Right.
Once you understand quantum physics, you say, wait a minute, the iron filings fell into this position because the field forced them to go into this position. Yeah, but what's the field? That's the invisible stuff. So the invisible stuff gave shape to the iron filings. Got it?
Right.
Well, there's a quote that Albert Einstein says, if we say this, then all of a sudden it will tie some of the biology, that new weird biology, in. It goes like this. The quote from Albert Einstein is, the field is the sole governing agency of the particle. So by definition, the field, that's the invisible stuff, like the magnetic field. You can't see it. It's part of the energy, right?
Right.
The particles mean matter. In physics, particles are matter. So when you listen to what Einstein said, he said, the field is the sole governing agency of matter.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in the iron filing stuff, right? What governed the filings to be in that pattern? And it was the sole governing agency of that was the invisible field.
Right.
Okay? Well, it turns out that's the basis of physics. It basically says that all the matter that's around us and everything is connected to these invisible fields. And since we've never acknowledged the field, then we're missing
right.
half the equation.
So the field is primary and matter is sort of secondary.
Exactly, exactly. That's what quantum physics says.
Mm-hmm.
As compared to Newtonian physics, it says ignore the invisible and just focus on the matter. The quantum physics comes in and says, no. You can look at the matter, but you can't ignore the invisible because it shapes the matter. So
you know, it's amazing to me how long these ideas have been around and how many examples have been shown. We were talking on the air a couple weeks ago about this old Russian research that was called Carillion photography.
Oh, yeah, Carillion photography, very good stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, same story, right?
Yeah, it's been around. It's been studied for years, but it's not. We don't bring it into the medicine.
Right.
And let me add, just take Albert Einstein's equation. So we add this, it becomes one last little important boost to the understanding. The field is the sole governing agency of the particle. The mind is a thought. Our thoughts are fields. The mind is energy.
Mm-hmm.
The mind is the field. The particles are the cells in the body. So if you read Albert Einstein's quote, it goes, the field is the sole governing agency of the particle, or the mind is the sole governing agency of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the new medicine is coming to come from. It's basically saying, we kept trying to push the cells around and try to figure out why they weren't working right and why their structures were all off. And it turns out, that's because you missed the invisible stuff. The mind was the field, like a giant magnet,
right,
causing a big field that gave shape to your body. Distortions in your mind result in distortions of the matter of your body, just as a distortion in a magnet would reveal, the iron filings.
Sure,
show
sure.
A distortion. So it's like, that's how simple it is. And yet we make everything so complex, and the fact is, no, your mind is the energy field that gives shape to the particles, which are your body.
Mm.
And the new medicine is mind over matter medicine. And epigenetics is the mechanism by which signals from the mind released by the brain, etc., can control the reading of the genes. So the mind is controlling the genes. The matter is being controlled by the field.
Now, what about practical application? In other words, most people will even the people that you know, that don't need to be proven any further. In other words, there are people that say, yes, this makes sense, of course.
Okay.
And then they say, but how do I do it? I've been thinking this other way for so long that I can't get my head around it because of this, of the unconscious, the subconscious imprints that have been there forever, et cetera.
Yeah. Now, here, this is very interesting because the first thing is people have heard about positive thinking.
Sure.
Well, there's a problem here, and I'll tell you what it is, because it doesn't work a lot, and it frustrates more people than it heals, actually.
Yeah, then they think they're worse off because it didn't work for them.
It didn't work for them. Well, let me explain why it didn't work so that we can clear the issue right away. I said there are two minds, the conscious mind and the subconscious mind. The conscious mind works about 5% of the day. The subconscious mind, 95% of the day. The subconscious mind only plays programs that have been recorded, and the conscious mind is creative, okay?
Right.
So I say... And the subconscious mind is 1,000,000 times more powerful, too. So now all of a sudden I say, when you're having a positive thought, which mind do you think that comes from, the conscious or the subconscious?
Most likely the subconscious.
No, conscious.
Oh, okay.
It's a creative thought.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
It's not a program. It's just a desire.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
So your conscious mind is thinking, I want X. That's a conscious thought.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, that's coming from the mind that operates 5% of the day. And if the beliefs in the subconscious mind, the programmings in your life, don't agree with that belief, then you have a competition in a sense.
Mm, yeah.
So the subconscious mind is operating 95% of the day with a million times more powerful processor sabotaging your positive beliefs.
Mm.
And that's why positive beliefs don't work very well, because the only time they work is when the conscious mind has a desire and the subconscious mind was already programmed with a belief that says that that's possible.
That's right, or possible, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it says, okay, so what's the issue? And the issue is, well, you're trying to fight the subconscious mind. And okay, now here's where the big problems in history have come from. We have conventionally believed that the conscious mind and subconscious mind are connected to one another, so that if you understand something in your consciousness, it will change the program in the subconscious mind. So like in conventional psychology, you go to the psychologist and you review all the bad things that happened in your life. Your mom did this, your dad did that, your boyfriend, your girlfriend. You can go make the list and you relive all these experiences. And then the idea is that if you really understand all these events, you will now, with all that new awareness, go, oh, I got it. Now I'm well. That was the intention, of course.
Right.
And of course, the problem is this, that you can spend thousands and thousands of dollars, go over everything that happened in your life, and yet the answer is, when you get finished with all that, you still have the same problems anyway.
Mm.
And here's the reason. The conscious mind and subconscious mind are separate things, period. The conscious mind has an entity in it, meaning it's connected to your source, okay?
Right.
And this is the mind that can think and has ideas and desires and all that. That's the conscious mind. The subconscious mind, and this is very clear, and you know, this is precise, and it goes like this. The subconscious mind is the equivalent of a tape player. It records programs, and then, at the push of a button, plays the program back. It will record the program, and when you push the button, it will always play the same program back. There's no creativity there.
Mm.
The subconscious mind's not creative. It's a stimulus response. Push the button, play the response. Matter of fact, a lot of people say something like, oh, that guy pushed my buttons.
Hmm.
And it's really, and what do they mean? Well, they meant that their behavior got stimulated and they didn't like it because somebody did that.
Right.
Well, what that person did was actually, push the subconscious tape button, and the guy played the tape and all of a sudden realized he was playing the tape, okay?
Hmm.
So here's the point. The subconscious mind's function is to record experiences, especially repetitive things. That's a very important part of it, repeating things. If something happened once, the subconscious mind doesn't have any idea what the heck that means. But if things are repeated, that's the strength of the subconscious mind. Anything that's repeated, it can remember. And so here's the point.
And the more frequently it's repeated?
Yes, or and it can happen over frequency or the amount of emotion that it generates. Something that's so traumatic can take really just once. If it's totally traumatic, you'll never do that again. You know? So,
yeah.
So it really depends on the level of the emotional content of it.
Okay.
Low emotional content, more repetitive things. High emotional content takes very few times to learn that one, because the system is sensitized to that really fast. So here's the issue. The subconscious mind then is simply this. This is what it is. It's a machine. It records and plays tapes when you push the button. There's nobody in there. And this causes great problems, because most of us, me, everybody out there probably at some level, has tried to get their conscious mind to talk to their subconscious mind. Like, you know, I don't like this behavior, and I'm real tired, and I don't want to do this anymore. This is what I want.
Right.
That's the conscious mind. And then the point is, well, how effective is that? And here's how effective it is. It's like this. Get a tape player. Put a cassette tape in it. Push play. And as the program is playing, talk to the tape player and suggest that it change the tape. And you start to realize, well, that's silly. You can talk until you're blue in the face and the tape is still the same. And the answer is, well, there's the exact problem that we face in our human mind, is that we can see what we want to change, and we believe that if we give ourselves a good talking to, that the subconscious mind is going to be like a dutiful servant and say, yeah, okay, good, I'll change that for you. The reality is, well, you're talking to a machine. There's nobody in there. That's not how the subconscious learns. It doesn't learn by dialogue. It learns by the repetitive nature of these experiences. And so the point is, for years, we've always thought if we become aware of things, or if we could talk to ourselves, that we would be able to change the subconscious mind. And the fact is, no, it does not change that way. It only leads to frustration. Because every effort of trying to correct yourself and yell at yourself and whatever you need to do to try to change and beat yourself with it, you know, doesn't change the tape player. And all your dialogue is wasted, because there's nobody in there to listen to that dialogue. And so therefore it says, oh my God, all the years, we haven't effectively been able to change those programs. And you can do it over, it's a lot of hard work, but as I said, you know, it's a lot of repetition and patterning and stuff like that. So the issue is, can we change these tapes? And the answer is absolutely. And I go back to the cassette player and I say, if you don't like the program on the tape, what do you do if you want to put another program on the tape? And the answer is, you push the record button. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, there's a process. You have to do something to activate the recorder. Okay? So all of a sudden it says, oh, you mean just talking to the tape player doesn't change? And the answer is no. But if you activate the recorder, you can change a belief in as short as like 10 minutes, a belief you may have had 30, 40, 50 years. And you can, 10 minutes, change this belief if you understand how to push the record button. If you don't understand how to do that, you can change the recording, but usually it's a lot of work and it may take months or years. So there's a new series of modalities, of new psychology, that are more or less based on the quantum physics than the Newtonian physics, based on energy, changing the field.
Yeah, you talk about some of this stuff at the end of your book.
Well, and I have a lot of resources on the website that you get all different versions of this. And so I'm not, you know, saying that there's one that's better than another. I mean, I have my own preferences, but there are these different modalities, and they're profound, and they're necessary now, because guess what? We're running out of time. We don't have the leisure of spending months and years trying to reprogram ourselves. But the new technology, it's sort of like necessity is the mother of invention. We're getting closer to, we don't have time to make these changes. And all of a sudden, guess what? These new energy healing modalities come out that say, okay, good, then make changes in 15 and 20 minutes. How about that? And like, whoa. And the answer to the amazing ability is that almost every one of these in some way or other activate the record button. So that you can rewrite a behavior over the top of your old behavior. And so when the button gets pushed, it's a behavior that is a benefit to you than a behavior that may sabotage you.
Bruce, a person asks here, not so much about behavior, but how would you approach something like a chronic illness or a chronic disease?
a chronic disease, and this is very important, I would do it the same way for the first reason as this. As I said, there are very few diseases that are really genetic. There's just a handful of them.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the things that we express as diseases are consequences of lifestyle and mindset. And it also becomes important to recognize this, is that diseases are, you see a disease, what you're seeing is a symptom of something going wrong. Blaming, like, the cancer cell for the problem is blaming the symptom.
Right.
The cancer was caused really because of a disconnect, really, between the central voice, the mind, and the community of cells that are listening to the mind. It's usually the result of anger. And you have to realize that these cells are like little people. They're living in this world. They're people at their size. They're like, you know, one cell looks at another cell the same as you looking at another person
right.
to a cell. These are just other people.
Yeah, if one of them's trying to kill you.
Yeah, and the idea is when the government, which is the mind, is continuously disruptive, you can have a good government, you can have a bad government.
That's
the
for
world
sure.
is all filled with that. And recognize this, that when a government is bad, there's illness in the population. The population isn't whole. There isn't harmony. It doesn't work very well. And the diseases show up. That, matter of fact, the more fear that we've been under in the last 6 years has caused a health crisis greater than anything we've ever had before.
Mm, for sure.
And it's because the country is sick and the cells, us, we're the cells in a country.
Right, that make up the larger.
Right, and the central voice is the leadership is not supporting our survival. And the system is, we're dying in a system. And the reality is, guess what? In your own body, there are these trillions of citizens, and they're all plugged into your thoughts, your brain and your mind to the cells. Your brain and mind are the equivalent, let's say, of CNN and the government. That they send information to all the cells about what's going on all the time, keeping them informed about their chances for, this is, you know, how are we going to survive this or not? Well, it's what the government's telling you at this point. And if the government is particularly harsh or, if you don't have a government that's working for you, it could be undermining you in the guise of being your protector. It could kill you, okay? I don't have to talk too far from home at this point.
Yeah, no doubt.
Okay, and the reality is this. You have 50 trillion cells that are listening to your thoughts. And your thoughts are a directive for them, like the daily news of what's their world like. And if you listen to these thoughts, and psychologists have, and they tell us 70% or more of our thoughts are negative and redundant. And why that's relevant is, then imagine a government where, well, we don't have to imagine too far, where every day it's like bad news, like bad news, bad news. There's a point where this causes disharmony in the system. And all of a sudden, this disharmony leads to the illnesses that we have. And the issues are, if you correct the disharmony, the illnesses go away. If you try to focus on the illnesses, you're not recognizing the cause of the illness. You know, here, focusing on the illness, again, goes back, remember the story of the filings and the magnet.
Right.
It's the magnet field that shapes the filings. A chronic disease is generally an expression of a field that's distorted in some way. And since medicine doesn't recognize the field, it keeps trying to adjust the filings, the cells, and as if it's going to heal it. And the fact is, that's not what heals it. The healing is to go back and find out where is the field defective? Where is the belief? Where is the perception of life being self-destructive? And then you say, but, you know, I don't see myself as being self-destructive. And then I go back to the same story and I go, You see yourself with your conscious mind,
right,
but you don't see the subconscious.
Right.
Let me give this story so that people, they'll understand it because they're very familiar with it, most people. It goes like this. You know somebody, and you know their parent, and you recognize that this individual has the same behavior as their parent. So you say to your friend, you go, you know, Mary, you're just like your mom. And then you have to back away from Mary because she's going to look at you and start going, what are you talking about? I'm not like my mom. And the interesting fact is everybody else around Mary can see, geez, yeah, she sure is. Who's the one that doesn't see it? And the answer is Mary. And the answer is why? Because the programs, which she obviously got from her mom, in her subconscious play when she's not paying attention. So when she's playing the programs that are characteristic of her mother's behavior, they're coming from the subconscious, by definition means your conscious mind's not paying attention to what she's doing. And as a result, she doesn't see her own behavior. Well, this is my precise point. About 95% of our behavior is relatively invisible. We don't see it. And yet, 95%, that 95% is behavior that most of it was programmed by other people.
Right.
Therefore, if they don't have your wishes and your where you want in life, or they challenge you, because when we were kids, remember, first 6 years, download data. First 6 years, you just go to Kmart and watch parents yell at little infant kids, you know, little kids.
Yeah.
And realize, if this kid isn't six, and this kid is a microphone and a video camera recording this, what are they hearing?
Right.
You don't deserve that. You're not a good kid.
Right.
You don't. You're
Get your hands up. Come with me. I'll give you this. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And what? And you know, let's just take a simple example. The kid's in the store throwing a tantrum, wants a toy. The parents want to get the heck out of there. They want to end this thing right away. What do they do? Billy, you don't deserve that.
Right.
And all of a sudden, that's the end of that, right? Well, Billy now has recorded that. Where? Subconscious mind. Okay, now Billy's 40 years old, and he's in some low-end job someplace, and his conscious mind, the thinking mind, says, man, I'm smarter than this. I should be running this office, for God's sake. What am I doing here? And then all of a sudden I say, okay, that's the one with the wishes and desires. That's the conscious mind that works 5% of the day.
Right.
I say, 95% of the day, what's running subconscious mind? I say, what's the program you do not deserve? And what does that mean? And this is the catch. The brain's function, it's a computerized system. The brain's function is to make coherence out of the program. If the program says you do not deserve, if you deserve something, that's a violation of the program.
Right, so you
will automatically, unconsciously sabotage yourself. And go back, most of us out there, listen to this. You've been in a school. How many times have you gotten an exam back where you marked an answer wrong? When you read that question, you said, I knew the answer to that. As most everybody has. And you say, how come so many of us mark questions wrong when we knew the answer? And the point was, it's because the subconscious mind had already... You've been told who you were. You're an average student. Oh, if you got told that, if you get above an average grade, you're not an average student. So the subconscious mind says, oh, no, I'm an average student. I have to miss this number of questions so I can be an average student. It's not the thinking mind. It's just the habit mind that says, how many questions must I miss to be average? And it picks a bunch of them, and there you go. Now you're an average kid all of a sudden. The issues are, most of us got off the ground with very bad programming. Very bad programming that are very limiting and not loving and critical and self-critical. And the issues are, these are the programs that operate when we're not watching 95% of the day. They're invisible. And then this leads us to put myself in a position if I can't see the field. I can't see it, so I can't blame my own behavior because I didn't see it. And so when my life doesn't work out, then I have to automatically say, well, wait a minute. It wasn't me. I was looking for success. So the world is not my friend, and I've failed because the world didn't help me. Because I'm the one, my intention was to succeed. And the fact was, that was your conscious intention.
Hey, Bruce.
Yeah.
We've got about 10 minutes left, and I've got a couple things that I want to make sure that I get in.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question about... First of all, similar things happening in other fields of science. In other words, revolutionary things that are happening in physics. I hear, you know, I talk to lots of people from different areas of endeavor, and frankly, the changes and the new ideas and the new science that you're talking about in biology is happening in many, many different fields of science.
Every field of science at this time in the history of the world is undergoing a renaissance.
Mm.
And it's in chemistry and physics and psychology and biology and every and mathematics. All of that is changing.
Right.
And it's very important because the new belief will shape a culture that can survive what we're going through right now and thrive through it when it understands the nature of balance and harmony and entanglement and all that.
Well, this leads me to my last question, and then anything else you'd like to fill in for the rest of the show. But, and it may seem like a strange one, but you mentioned love. And it seems to me and this is just an experiential observation over time, but love has some sort of a weird effect on things, does it play a role?
Love is an energy. It's not just an energy; it's a harmony, and
a powerful one.
It's extremely powerful. That's why it's in biological reality. It is more powerful on the human body than anything else in the world is on the human body. In other words, it can override bad food and toxic environments and all that stuff. That people can come out of a war zone and walk through it. Mm. If they're in love, there's a harmony that gives them power that's almost invincible. And that's why we seek it so much. Because when it's operating with you and it's working with you, it feeds you more than like nutrition can feed you. Okay? It makes harmony. And the interesting thing is, if I looked at it at a physics level, I said, what is the difference between health and disease? And the answer is, health is harmony and disease is disharmony. That as you get more harmony in life, you get more health in your life. And love is a sensation of experiencing a harmony. That's what the interpretation of the biology is. It feels the harmony, and then we give it a name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that's the drive, and it's the most powerful factor on this planet. And it's an unfortunate situation because, as I said, if you go back to our own individual programming, especially before six, especially with parents that were critical. And the interesting thing is, critical parents were not trying to be bad parents. They were figuring that if they would, you know, give you like, come on, you could do better and all that stuff, that, you know, that would encourage you to, you know, to be a better person.
Right.
What they didn't recognize is by saying these things they said, they were inferring to the young mind, which was recording it, I'm not good enough.
Right.
You know, so you get three A's and you get a C. And all you hear all weekend after the report card is, what's that stupid C all about?
Right.
And the fact that the three A's were there disappeared somewhere in the dialogue.
Mm.
And the point was, you were never good enough. And this becomes a problem because it was programmed before we were conscious. And once you get older, you can say, oh, yeah, I understand what my parents were trying to do.
Right.
But you put yourself back in before six and just take the literal recording, like you hold a microphone up to what they said, and record that in your subconscious, and that's what you become. And when they say the things that they intend to make you better, but are actually not, because they're criticizing you and telling you of your, you know, your lesser abilities, and not giving you credit for what you can do.
Right.
Those are the programs that operate 95% of the day. Again, it's like, it's just to push the button. It says, I am not good enough. I don't deserve things. I'm not smart enough. I am a sickly child. That's a belief, too.
Right.
Or the belief is, I only get love when I am sick. That's what it learned.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it learned. When it gets older, the only program it has is, how do I get love? It goes back in the database and says, oh, here's the tape, how to get love. I push the tape and it says, get sick. Okay, that's to the individual. But is it in their conscious mind? Are they consciously saying, I wish I had this diabetes? And the answer is no.
Of course not.
The conscious mind doesn't. That's not the conscious mind. It's the subconscious mind that says, you're going to get some perks with this diabetes.
Wow.
So it all of a sudden it says that we really have power, and yet our beliefs run our biology. So if we buy a belief of being disempowered, then that's the biology.
Right.
And there was a you know, Henry Ford, of course you're out in that area, you know, in the Ford Motor Company.
Sure.
He had a statement that summed it all up exactly. He said, very simple, but it's exactly what we're talking about. He said, whether you believe you can or whether you believe you can't, you're right. And it really basically says is that your life will be a manifestation of your beliefs, and unfortunately the beliefs that we operate from are invisible, and they're not the beliefs in your conscious mind, and that's where we generally have a disconnect in our lives.
Let's see.
Because our desires are sometimes hard to find and to acquire, because we don't realize the invisible behavior is shooting yourself in the foot.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time.
Let's see. Well, I'll be darned. Incredible, incredible stuff, Bruce Lipton. Thank you so much, Mike.
This is wonderful because this is where the world is, the stuff I'm talking about is going to become mainstream. And it is a requirement because the only way out of the mess that we're creating is to date back the power we already had.
I agree.
But gave it away to other people when we bought their beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're making some headway for sure if people like you and I are talking about it and a lot of people are listening. And I don't consider myself quite as fringe as I used to, frankly. So
I think fringe is catching up with you and passing you now.
Well, I think it's a good thing. And I'm really pleased that we had a chance to talk. And once again, thanks so much for your work, Bruce.
Mike, thank you for this wonderful opportunity. I appreciate it. Thank you again.
All right, you take care of yourself, all right?
All right.
Everybody, Dr. Bruce Lipton on the web, www.brucelipton.com. And you can link over there from my site at mikehagan.com from here on out. And, of course, this program will be up in the archives in the next couple of days, all right? All right, one more time, a big thank you to Bruce Lipton. Wonderful stuff.